Hello, and welcome to episode 109 of SMARTS, which, as we all know, stands for...
Succubus Monster Attacks Romans, Terrorizing Scotland!
Oh no.
Oh no! Go ahead, finish the intro.
I am Trevor, aka Rediger Q Podcaster.
Hello!
And you are...
Julia Guglia of Internet Fame, a Dash Podcaster.
Correct.
Yay! I got one quiz question right.
Not yet.
Too early? Not yet? Oh, okay. Okay, what's next?
Next is news.
Yay!
So, quite a bit of news for this time of year, kind of all over the place. So there was an article about the arrangement that Marvel has with Sony regarding sharing the Spider-Man rights. And it was mentioned in the article, and I thought it was interesting, that the sequel to Spider-Man Homecoming, which we talked about before, has already been put on the schedule for, I think, a couple of years from now, will not prominently feature Iron Man as Spider-Man Homecoming will prominently feature a different Marvel hero.
Ooh.
So it seems like, as a way of like reminding the audience that these are part of the Marvel universe, they're going to have a prominent guest star in each Spider-Man movie. So oh. I guess the question is who, and I don't know. I mean, the obvious other choices would be like have Captain America in there or something, but you also have to consider the fact that a couple of years from now, some of the original actors might be done with their contracts.
Yeah.
So who would you like to see?
Nick Fury.
Show up. Nick Fury? That wouldn't surprise me, because they're really pulling from the Ultimate Spider-Man comics for these movies, it looks like. And a big thing in the Ultimate Spider-Man comics was Nick Fury kind of being a mentor to Spider-Man.
Oh, interesting.
And trying to, you know, coach him. And in a lot of the ways, it seems like Tony Stark is going to be a mentor to him in this first movie. Kind of helping him out, taking him to task when he doesn't do something right, helping him be a better hero, or encouraging him to team up with other heroes and stuff.
Right.
So they could do that. I don't know. I mean... I wonder if they'll try to prop up one of the newer heroes, like if they'll have it be Doctor Strange or Captain Marvel or something like that. There's obviously plenty of opportunity to introduce other new characters, but I don't know if they would do that, because then you would kind of get to the point where Spider-Man is mentoring, you know, you could introduce Ms. Marvel or something and have Spider-Man be mentoring another new character, but I'm not sure they want to step him up to the mentor role yet. So
right.
I think that they're going to bring in another more senior hero and have it be that. So whether it's Hulk or Thor or Captain America or something, I don't know.
Well, Hulk would be the reluctant mentor, you know?
That would be interesting, though. A Hulk Spider-Man team-up movie?
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
We'll see what they do. There was a pretty wide-ranging interview with Geoff Johns and John Berg, who are, of course, the two guys that are running DC Films these days, about the current state of the DC Extended Universe and the movies that are coming up. So a couple of things from this. Geoff Johns dropped that he is currently working with Patty Jenkins on story ideas for Wonder Woman 2. She has not, or so far as we know, been officially signed to direct the movie yet.
Okay.
But it's at least promising that everybody is proceeding under the assumption that she will be.
Awesome.
It's not like she's been booted and we just haven't heard about it yet.
Yeah. If they're talking to her, they're serious.
They were also remarkably candid about the flaws of some of the movies so far. Like, they can't, I think they can do this because they weren't involved in those other movies.
Sure.
So they can kind of throw some of the previous people under the bus and say, I mean,
they weren't
doing it in a mean way, but they were doing it in sort of a mea culpa way. They're like, Wonder Woman is the first movie that really came out the way we envision these DC movies being.
Right.
They said that, Suicide Squad had story problems from day one. It shouldn't have been shot in the state that it was. There should have been more work done in the script. Batman v Superman was darker than we think it should have been. Like all the things that the fans have been saying, you know, too dark, not enough attention paid to the script before filming starts, all these kinds of things. Not to say that every movie from here on out is going to be a home run, but I think that they now kind of have their true north set.
Yes.
The watchword is hope and optimism for these movies, like they've said. It's not to say that every movie is going to be bright and shiny. I mean, Wonder Woman was in places a very dark movie. It's just that it had this underlying... I mean, listen to our Wonder Woman megasode, which will come out in a few weeks if you want to hear more of our thoughts on the Wonder Woman movie. But as dark as it was in places, it had a core of inspiration and optimism to it. And that's, I kind of feel like, the balancing act that the DC movies need to strike. You can tell a dark Superman story.
Sure.
If you want, but Superman should not be the dark character in that movie.
Yes.
Which is kind of the fault that some of the previous movies fell into, where Superman was like the most depressed character in the movie, you know?
Yeah.
So it's nice to hear them own up to that. And I feel like, you know, some people have their issues with Geoff Johns as a writer and some of his, you know, tics and some of the tropes that he plays into. But I think that even his detractors would say that he has a good sense for, you know, what the characters should represent and the kind of tone the story should strike. So I think, you know, and personally, I love his writing too. So I think having these guys on board writing the movies, if Wonder Woman is any indication, I mean, the next test will be Justice League, but that might be potentially the last movie that's kind of a half and half from the old guard and the new guard.
Right.
Especially since Zack Snyder is, well, you know, Zack Snyder plus Joss Whedon. That movie is going to be sort of an odd duck in a bunch of ways. It'll be interesting to see how well it hangs together. But potentially that will still have some vestiges of the old way of thinking. And then moving forward, things will be different. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Wonder Woman came, you know, there's months between Wonder Woman and Justice League.
Yep.
So if they were able to nail Wonder Woman, they had even more time for Justice League. So I'm optimistic about that.
Mm-hmm.
They also, and so this was not in the interview, but there was a separate article, a rumor going around that DC isn't quite happy with the way that their projected slate is kind of shaking out, because Aquaman is in production right now. Obviously, Justice League comes out in a few months. But they were hoping to do two movies a year. I think Flash was going to be the other movie they wanted to do next year, but they keep having directors dropping out.
Yep.
So next year is just going to be Aquaman. And then the year after that is Justice League 2, and I'm not sure what else is on the schedule for that. I don't think it's time for the Cyborg movie yet. I think that might be maybe the Batman, I think, in 2 years, the Batman and Justice League or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, they've announced a lot of other projects that we've talked about on the show that don't have dates yet. Joss Whedon's Batgirl movie, the Nightwing movie, the Justice League Dark movie that keeps popping up here and there. There was talk about a Booster Gold movie for a while. Like I said, the Batman movie, this Gotham City Sirens, Harley Quinn thing, Suicide Squad 2, potentially Wonder Woman 2, potentially another Superman movie. There's a lot of stuff that's been announced that is in development, but there's no hard dates for any of this yet. But the rumor is that DC, coming off a year or two where they're only going to have maybe one movie a year, they want to get to the point where they're doing like maybe three or four movies a year. So that would be incredibly ambitious. Marvel did two a year for years, and now they're stepping up to doing three a year. For DC to come out of the gate more or less aiming for three or four a year is very ambitious. I don't know if that'll actually end up happening yet, but they have enough projects in development right now that they could do it. I mean, I just listed 10 projects right there, in addition to the ones that were announced but are ways off, like Shazam, Green Lantern Corps, Cyborg, Flash, whenever that ends up happening, plus potential sequels to all those things, plus the Black Adam spinoff that The Rock wants to do and all this other stuff, right? So, I mean, they have enough projects in the works. Like, if they do three of those a year, they still have enough movies there to last 5-6 years, plus potential sequels and spinoffs and all the other stuff. Like, any of these movies could spin out. I mean, you could do a series of Nightwing movies. You could do a series of Batgirl movies. You could merge, you could do a bunch of Batgirl movies and then spin that off into a Birds of Prey kind of thing, where Barbara Gordon gets paralyzed. Now she's Oracle. Like, obviously all these characters have gone on for so long in the comics that you could do an infinite number of movies. So, I mean, I would love that if they're all good, if they're able to maintain the quality like Marvel generally does. But I think it'll probably be a few years before we see that bear fruit. And again, that's just a rumor that that's what they want to do, but I believe it based on how many projects they have in the fire right now. The rumor went on to say that expect a big announcement at San Diego Comic-Con to this effect. Maybe they will, at their big DC movie panel, announce a revised lineup of movies that takes into account things like Flash being put on hold and things like that, but incorporate some of the new projects like Batgirl, Nightwing, the Batman, Gotham City Sirens, and we'll see if that ends up amounting to three or more movies a year. But I would suspect if they're going to do that, I mean, some of these things have got to be pretty far along at this point. Apparently Joss Whedon's been working with them for a while, so it wouldn't surprise me to learn that that's less than a couple of years away. So yeah, they're going to need to start announcing these things pretty soon to lock down the dates.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me if we saw something in San Diego. So that's the thing to watch for. So that's in just a few weeks.
Squee.
So the other bit of movie news is probably the big news from this week, which you already know about, which is that Chris Miller and Phil Lord, the directors of the Star Wars Han Solo anthology movie, were basically fired by Lucasfilm. It was not from everything that's come out since then, it was not a particularly amicable breakup, nor was it really their idea.
Right.
So they're out, And then after just a few days, Lucasfilm announced that Ron Howard has been brought in to finish the movie. So for a bit of context, they'd already been shooting the movie for several months. They only had a few weeks left
like
of shooting.
Like 3 weeks left, yeah.
But the but production is being put on hold for about a month to let everybody kind of take a breath.
Acclimate.
And then Howard's going to go in and shoot for, I would imagine, now there's going to be a lot more than just those 3 weeks of shooting left. Because
yes.
God knows he might go in and reshoot huge chunks of the
movie. They still have
the
same target release date.
The release date is not changing, but people, you know, are saying, well, Rogue One underwent extensive reshoots, and that happened much closer to that release date than this.
Okay.
This is still 10 months away.
Yeah.
Right? Because Han Solo is, or whatever they end up calling it, is not coming out till next May. And
right,
Rogue One underwent extensive reshoots literally like 5 months before it was released.
Yeah.
So they have time. So Ron Howard could go in, he could reshoot the whole thing. I mean, it wouldn't surprise, not that I think they will necessarily, but it could be, what I'm sort of envisioning is a Richard Donner, Richard Lester, Superman 2 situation where Richard Donner had shot like 90% of the movie, but they brought Richard Lester in and he reshot it. And so what ended up making it to film was more than 50% Richard Lester material. And so Richard Lester was the only credited director because shot more than half of the movie. I'm not sure if the Directors Guild rules still work that way. If you shoot more than 50%, if yours gets to be the only name on the movie, but it wouldn't surprise me if Ron Howard ends up reshooting so much that his name is the only director name on this movie.
Wow.
It wouldn't surprise me. So all the stuff that's come out since, and again, this is hearsay, this is scuttlebutt, but it's come out from so many sources that I kind of believe, and it fits all the facts, which is basically that Miller and Lord were basically shooting a different movie than Lucasfilm wanted. They were shooting, Lucasfilm wanted a Star Wars movie with comedic elements, but Miller and Lord were shooting a comedy.
Oh.
So Kathleen Kennedy, who's been at Lucasfilm for like 30 years and is now running it, and Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote the script for this movie and has been doing script work on Star Wars movies since the original trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
He helped out on the screenplays for like Empire and Jedi.
Wow.
And so he knows Han Solo.
Right.
And he was apparently, it was Kasdan more than anybody else that was unhappy with the way things were developing because they were not shooting the movie that he wrote.
Right.
He wrote a movie that had comedic elements, but Han Solo was still Han Solo. Han Solo was not a comedic character necessarily. Mm-hmm. He can do and say funny things sometimes, but what Kasdan apparently wrote was like a Star Wars movie where Han Solo is Han Solo, but like sometimes funny things are happening around him sometimes, but it's not a comedy necessarily, and Han Solo is certainly not like the funny guy in the movie.
Yep.
Whereas what Miller and Lord were shooting is like Han Solo it was like the funny character, which is not, I mean, I guess you could do that, and this is like a younger version of the character, so who knows what he was like in his teens and 20s, but Lawrence Kasdan and Kathleen Kennedy, you know, they've been at Lucasfilm for a long time, and Lawrence Kasdan has been writing Han Solo for 30, 35 years now, and he's like, guys, this is not what I'm writing. He's a producer on the movie, too, so he was on set, and he was growing increasingly dissatisfied with what they were shooting. The only question is why they let it go on so long. Maybe they kept thinking that they could kind of save it in editing, or that they kept thinking they could get Miller and Lord to fall in line, and it just wasn't happening. I'm amazed that they let it run this long. I think that's, if you want to say anything about anything anybody did wrong in this situation, I mean, it sounds like it was just a creative mismatch.
Right.
But I think if anybody did anything wrong in this situation, it was not recognizing the problem was unsolvable earlier on and you know, putting a stop to it early on, like in the pre-production stage or just very shortly into shooting, you know, when you realize you've got Eric Stoltz, Michael J. Fox, Marty McFly situation where like after a couple of weeks, we're like, sorry, this isn't working out.
Yeah.
We got to get Michael J. Fox in here to do Back to the Future because you're not working out, Eric Stoltz.
Right.
Go off and wait 30 years to do Caprica. So that's the problem here. So anyway, all this is like scuttlebutt industry, you know, back alley talking and so on. But I believe it because it seems like that's what everybody is saying. So it's too bad. As far as Ron Howard coming in, he was one of the early names that was floated.
Really?
And it makes a lot of sense. Don't forget, he has a long-standing relationship with the Lucasfilm family going all the way back to Willow, which was a Lucasfilm production.
I do remember that. They wrote it up in The Verge, and I was like, how does Ron Howard... Because in my head, all I remember him is from well, obviously Arrested Development, for anybody who's seen that show, well, they know he's the narrator and show creator.
And Apollo 13, uh-huh. A Beautiful Mind, all the, and, you know, take them or leave them, but all the
but I didn't associate
Da Vinci
him
Code
with,
movie yes. adaptations.
He was in the Da Vinci Code?
He's directed all the Tom Hanks, Dan Brown movie adaptations.
Did he? Oh, yeah. Wow. I'm so ignorant. Wow. I didn't know that. I knew he did a lot of work, but...
But he's, I mean, he's... Apollo 13 and A Beautiful Mind, I'm pretty sure, were both nominated for
Absolutely.
Oscars. And I think them, some,
no,
of them,
some of them won.
So
yeah.
So what Ron Howard gets you is... And this is what I said to you as soon as I saw that Miller and Laura Fryer, I said they're going to want to keep it in the family because they're not going to want to run a
risk. That's what I thought.
So I thought they'd try to get somebody who's doing one of the other movies, Colin Trevorrow or Gareth right. Edwards yep. or Rian Johnson, but they're all too busy or they're doing something. Like I don't know. So what Ron Howard gets him is he's as close as you get to being able to keep it in the Lucasfilm family, short of getting like Lucas or Spielberg, and Spielberg
right.
was probably not going to do it. So it gets you that. It gets you instant credibility with the industry and with the cast, because you want, and this at this point, what you need is you need a steady hand.
Yes.
You don't want to bring in another untested director mm-hmm. that the cast and the crew are going to be wary of, you
yep.
know, because maybe they really like working with the other guys and they're going to feel betrayed. Who's this new guy coming in?
Right.
You bring in a veteran director who's mm-hmm. got like Academy Award nominations and classic films under his belt. And is generally known in the industry to be like a nice, affable guy who gets along with his cast and crew and everything. This gets you that. It gets you a veteran with a steady hand mm-hmm. and a trusted name, you know? And he's obviously a skilled director too. So I think it's a win-win. I mean, tonally speaking, his movies are not as comedic, it mm-hmm. seems to me. I mean, obviously he grew up acting in comedies. Mm-hmm. But as far as his directing is concerned, it's been mostly drama from what I've seen. So I think that you're going to see a pretty sharp turn in the tone of this movie. The finished product will presumably reflect his tone a lot more than Miller and Lord's, but I think it's a good choice. I mean, I think the only person they could have got that would have been better would have been Spielberg, but I don't think yeah. if you're going to get Spielberg to direct a Star Wars movie. And apparently he said that he's not going to do that. He was originally what Lucas wanted to do Jedi with Spielberg, but he didn't want to do it. But because he has all the same things going for him. He's a veteran. He's like a Hall of Famer. He's got the Lucasfilm ties because of the Indiana Jones movies.
Right.
That would have been the best choice. But that's like, I don't think you're going to get him to come in and finish somebody else's movie. He's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
You know, he's
yeah.
one of the most renowned directors of all time. So I think Ron Howard gets you those things, but he's like, you know, one tier down, you know? He's like the non-union Mexican equivalent of Steven. It's Senior Spielbergo, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I have to disagree with you. It's just that I see why... I really like most of what Spielberg has done, but I can see him being more up his own butt about taking over from somebody else's project, whereas I can see that Ron Howard would be more amicable to being like, yeah, of course I'll come in and lend a hand.
I'm not sure Spielberg has much of a reputation for having a big ego, but I think that you wouldn't want to bring Spielberg in to finish somebody else's movie, because I think that there would just be too much of a clash of brands there going on. Like, wait, is this a Spielberg movie or is this something else?
Like, you think so? Like,
I think Spielberg's the tone of his movies would probably fit better for a kind of a, because I mean, the Indiana Jones movies are funny movies.
Yeah.
E.T. has got a lot of comedic elements
yep.
in it. His movies are like fun family movies generally.
Yes.
Obviously he's done darker stuff,
sure.
but his movies are generally fun family movies. Ron Howard's movies, from what I've seen, aren't. So it's interesting that they, and we're saying this as if Spielberg was right there at their doorstep and they said, no, we don't want you, Spielberg. We're going with Howard. I don't think they were ever even considered going with Spielberg. But I'm just saying, like, in a perfect world, that would be, I think, the only better choice, because I think that his tone would fit even better in the Star Wars universe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Ron Howard would be an interesting choice for, say, a Star Trek movie, to me. Like that sort of serious drama. But the historical accuracy of Apollo 13,
kicking
or,
off a whole bunch of internal debates of like film lovers and this cross section of film lovers and Star Wars aficionados talking about what director, like the fantasy football lineup of directors and cast for like any sort of number of fictitious or non fictitious films that are out there, like Yeah. No,
I think it's a good choice. I think that they have enough time now for him to go in and make the changes he wants to make. I think that this month they're taking before they resume shooting is basically just him sitting down with the footage and saying, what can I salvage from this?
Right.
And then they're going to shoot everything that they need to finish it.
Yeah.
The other thing to tie this back to our DC news, Lord and Miller were at one point attached to the Flash movie.
Oh.
But then that fell through and they went off to do this. So now that the Flash movie is looking for a director again and they're out of work,
right.
I've been seeing a lot of people saying that DC should try to get them back for the Flash movie. Because that kind of funny tone
that'd be right up
would
Mary
be
Ellen's.
Pretty good for, depending on the kind of tone they want to do with the Flash movie, of if course. They want to make it fun.
I hope they would want to make it fun because Barry Allen is a very lighthearted and friendly and affable character.
I think of all the DC movies in the offing right now, with the possible exception of maybe Batgirl, I think Flash seems like it'd be the best fit for their tone.
Their tone, yeah.
More so than, say, Nightwing or maybe Captain Marvel. I could see Captain Marvel being that. I mean, Shazam. If they want to go with like a classic wish fulfillment, Tom Hanks in big kind of little kid in an adult's world with magical powers and talking tigers, they'd be a pretty good fit for that too, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So I could see them going with either one of those. But it seems like the big studios right now. I mean, Patty Jenkins was going to do Thor 2, but then that fell out, and then she went on to do Wonder Woman, and then. You know, Joss Whedon did two Avengers movies for Marvel, and now he's over working at DC, and they were good. You know, it just seems like between the Marvel franchise, the DC franchise, and Star Wars, it's just musical chairs with about 12 different directors moving around, you know?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised to see them land in one of those other camps. I think that now I wouldn't expect to see them do a Marvel movie anytime soon, because it's all Disney, right? And I think they're done at Disney for the time being. I think that they kind of burn their bridges with Disney, you know, not that they quit, they were fired, like I said, but I think that it's going to be a while before Disney wants to work with them again after what are undoubtedly going to be very expensive reshoots that from Disney's perspective, these guys cost them, you know? So, whereas DC would probably be more willing to work with them. So assuming they can get on the same page from day one about what the tone of the movie is going to
right.
be. But yeah, it's probably everybody's fault and nobody's fault. Like, it just seems like bad communication all over the place, but
yeah.
But like I say, I trust Kathleen Kennedy and Lawrence Kasdan as far as the kind of tone that a Han Solo movie should have, more than I trust two guys who haven't seen any of their movies. I mean, they're good from what I hear.
I was just wondering, really, like, I would love to be a fly on the wall for those discussions because I'm wondering how deep the rabbit hole goes in terms of, did Lawrence Kasdan write a script that they just... didn't film? Like,
I think from what I've heard, they were shooting his scenes, but with the wrong from his perspective, the wrong tone. And then there were also, but they would shoot his script, and then they would say, okay, let's do more takes, and they would they'd let the actors improvise and do their own stuff, which is fine. But if they're planning on using those takes instead of what he wrote, then that's a problem. If
right.
he wants them to use what he wrote, right? Like, there's certain
movies. Yeah, there's a line you don't.
There's certain movies that have that improvisation, and there's certain movies that don't. And if the studio and the producers are telling you don't improvise, and then you go in and shoot and edit your movie around improvised scenes, then that's a problem.
Right. Exactly. You're literally not filming any of the lines that the studio and the writer were behind. So,
I mean, some of the best, I mean, arguably the most iconic Han Solo moment of all time, which was the I love you, I know moment, was improvised.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's not like improvisation regarding Han Solo is always
and
a bad
Carrie
thing.
Carrie Fisher, actually, even at the age of 19, she script doctored a couple of her own lines or a scene here and there. And I mean, her notes are like public access now because she did unbelievable touch-up work in terms of the dialogue and the way it
felt. Well,
and
she went on to be predominantly a writer later in her life,
yes,
too.
Yes, like, I know
she would do script work, and then obviously she would
but
write,
she
like,
had
her memoirs.
The writer gene, like, all the way back then, yeah. And even though that was, like, one of her first acting gigs as a 19-year-old, she just had a feeling for how things sound naturally and how they don't, and they absolutely went with her. I mean, I can't call it improvisation, but they definitely let her touch up at least her own lines, and then they saw that she had a flair for it, so they went, you know, I don't think she got credited as a writer in any of those movies, but she helped make some of those scenes as iconic, you know, as I Love You, I Know.
So in other news, mm-hmm. we talked a few weeks ago about how HBO is developing a Watchmen series
mm-hmm.
for television. now the rumor, I'm not sure how strong a rumor it is, but now the report is that Damon Lindelof, who was, you know, from Lost and now the Leftovers, is the guy that they're looking at to do that series.
Who's David Lindelof in Lost? Who did he
The play? Showrunner.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay.
Okay.
No, I just, I was like, who was he? Wait, what role did he play?
So he will apparently be the guy in charge of that show if all this ends up happening. Okay. I think that's a pretty good choice. I mean, I haven't seen any of Lost or The Leftovers, but from what I've heard, they have structurally they're kind of similar to how I would imagine this show would be, with a very complex structure involving a lot of flashbacks and and a large cast.
I just hope it's a little lighter in tone than Lost was. Lost was.
You hope that Watchmen is going to be lighter in tone than Lost? I think you're going to be disappointed.
Okay, fair enough. Actually, that's a perfect match.
I mean, The Leftovers, which again I haven't seen, is a very. I mean, from what I've heard, just based on the premise, which is that like a large percentage of Earth's population just disappears one day, and how does the world move on from that?
Basically, rapture.
sounds to me like the kind of tone that this would have, which is just this feeling of doom kind of hanging over the proceedings constantly.
Well, that was Lost in a nutshell, all seven seasons of it. So, but it was really well architectured. I mean, there were some seasons of Lost that that were sort of slow, and I watched the whole series. I did. The last season I kind of binge watched, but I can't. Anyway, I know that tone very well, and I know the intricacies, and it really does pull you in. So they picked a good guy if that's exactly what they want to do with Watchmen. And you're right, Watchmen is definitely more dark and introspective and sad at times about the state of humanity as a whole, along with, you know, superheroes who are actually quite villainous at times and flawed. Like the comedian, I kind of want to punch him in the face, but I think that's his nature. Anyway, so it'll be interesting. That's a heck of a direction to go, but I think they picked a winner for somebody who can handle flashbacks and somber scenes that need a lot of time. That's one thing I can tell you that he has a sense for. It's like you need time for scenes to breathe if they're going to be all heavy and Debbie Downer at times. And he has a very good sense for how much is too much and how much is perfect. So interesting.
So in other TV news, we also finally have a premiere date for Star Trek Discovery. So it will start on September 24th.
Hooray!
And again, the first episode will air on CBS broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
All the subsequent episodes will only be available on the CBS All Access streaming service. But apparently what they're doing is same day as the first episode airs on CBS, you'll also be able to get the second episode on CBS All Access. So that's a pretty clever way of getting... I've seen other shows do this before too, where they make like the first... Even though the first episode only just aired on Sci-Fi, they will make the first three episodes available on iTunes and make the first one free or something like that. Like, you want to strike while the iron is hot. So if people watch the first episode and CBS say, oh, this is really good, and say, oh, you know, you can watch the second one right now, if you just start your free trial for CBS All Access, you're going to get a lot of people doing that. As opposed to if they just have to wait a week, in which case they'll kind of forget, or they're like, you know what, maybe it wasn't that good. You know,
I hope
you strike while the iron is hot.
I mean, software-wise, I hope they make it an easy process, because I think that onboarding people is a lot easier if you have something where you can literally just click here to see episode two right now.
And some of these streaming services now, I think we've pretty much got it down as far as the sign-up process.
Yeah, well, I have to argue yes and no on that, because sometimes it like takes you away from where you just were, and then you have to remember what you were doing, and then you have to log in, and then you have to give your information and stuff. It's not as seamless as all that, you know, and especially with the remote, if you're doing it on your TV, the interface is a lot slower because, you know, you have to whatever, blah 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 blah, first world problems. But but yeah, it would be easier if it was somehow linked more effortlessly. Then I know they're gonna onboard a lot of people that way. You're right, because people want that immediate next feeding.
So we'll start on September 24th. They'll run through the first half of the season, then the second half of the season will pick up after the holidays, so it'll be 15 episodes total, so I guess 8 and 7 or 7 and 8. There's a bunch of interviews this week where some of the people involved addressed all of the concerns about why the show had so many delays.
Because
Brian Fuller was left the production. He wasn't fired. He chose to leave because he had to choose between doing either this or American Gods, and he chose to focus more on American Gods. But that seemed like it kicked off the whole spate of delays that have been plaguing the show, where it was supposed to start last year, and then it was going to be early this year, and now it's the fall. And they basically said, I mean, they didn't address the Brian Fuller thing. I think that probably set them back because they had to find new showrunners. But aside from that, to hear them tell it, the delays basically amounted to two things. One was, it's a very complex production with very intricate sets, costumes, special effects, and it takes a longer time to, it takes more pre-production time than just some show where they can shoot on a normal soundstage or on location. Two, they also needed to wait for some of the actors' availabilities to free up. Like Sonequa Martin-Green, they needed to wait until she finished shooting the season of Walking Dead before they could even start shooting with her.
Right.
So that pushed things back too. So they might have thought they were going to start last year, but then once they decided who they wanted to cast, then they were at the whims of the
actors' availability.
So, I mean, I'm sure it's a confluence of factors, but all that's believable. So, I mean, I'm sure that Fuller leaving didn't exactly leave them in a great place, but I don't think that this was a troubled production per se. I think it was a complex production with a lot of moving parts, and it took a while for everything to line up.
Right.
But now at least we finally have a solid release date. And then the last bit of news this week, so we talked a while ago about Greg Rucka leaving the Wonder Woman comic, and we mentioned that what I presumed, and it turns out correctly, to be the temporary replacement creative team was announced to do like a 5 or 6 issue arc. But now we know who the new ongoing writer is going to be of the Wonder Woman comic. It's going to be James Robinson, who I'm happy with. I don't think you've read any of his stuff before, but he's done a lot of great stuff for DC. He did a great miniseries called The Golden Age. He did how long was Starman? 75 issues, 80 issues? But Starman is one of like the great all-time runs on a DC series. And he created and wrote every issue of that. And he's done a lot of other great stuff. He's been working for Marvel more recently, but apparently DC lured him back to do this. So he's great, and he has a real... He's one of the big, like him and Geoff Johns, I guess you could say, and maybe a few others like Mark Waid, but he is one of like the big DC history buffs.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows his DC history. He's one of those guys that will throw in little obscure characters here and there that have this huge history behind them, and he'll work in an explanation for some obscure bit of trivia or whatever. So that's not to say that all his stuff is just fan service. He's a very, very strong writer too, but he has a really good... sense of DC's history, and he's really good at establishing a large, likable, supporting cast that you want to spend more time with. So depending on how long his run lasts on Wonder Woman, I can see him being a really good choice for that. And apparently he's going to pick up a story thread that was dropped by Geoff Johns a couple of years ago before Rebirth started that I don't think you're aware of and won't spoil for you. It has to do with like a secret that the Amazons are keeping that'll come back to that. So I don't know if that means that Wonder Woman will get to go back to Themyscira after all, after... I told you at the end, Greg Rucka's running, like, that's not going to last for very long. I don't know. Maybe we'll just sort of see that from a distance, but I'm looking forward to seeing him start. So that's a ways off because Rucka has one more issue left, and then Shea Fontana has her 5 or 6 issues, and then he starts. But that's all biweekly, so that's still only 2 or 3 months away. So I'm looking forward to that.
Exciting.
So should we move on to our comics of the week?
Yes, ready.
So what is your comic of the week?
I forgot. No, what is my comic of the week?
Super Sons number 5?
How did you know? That's exactly right. Because I told you ahead of time, and I'm glad you wrote it down. Yes, Super Sons number 5. So for me, number one, the art was different than the artist usually is. I know that you're far more savvy with retaining information about who the artist is week to week, and if they tap in a sub, then who that person is, and you're familiar with a whole host of people and a whole bodies of work. But I'm not. So to me, as a casual reader, all I really internalized was, oh, this style is different, but oh my gosh, it's super cute. So here, the boys are independently being punished by their respective parents for the last adventure in which they faced off against the Amazo robot creating bad guy. And they came out of that scrape just fine, but they both got punished because they both sort of kind of ran off on their own to have that adventure in the first place. So, of course, there were trouble at home. Superman is not allowed to use his powers. Superboy is not allowed to use his powers. And Robin has been grounded in terms of not going out on patrol, not doing the thing that he likes. And he's staying at home in the Batcave, being punished for a whole week. Oh, my gosh. To to stay at home and not be a vigilante, which he really likes to go out and fight some crime and punch some boots in faces and stuff. So that's what he enjoys, and therefore Batman knows that that's exactly what the punishment ought to be, is that you get to stay home. So each of them are kind of stewing in their own juices, being mad at the other for, how dare he have caused me to get in trouble? It's totally his fault. And then eventually Superboy sort of has a little bit of a tantrum, as 10-year-old boys are wont to do, and he bounds off in jumping leaps to go to Gotham and sort of both pound on and sort of commiserate with his co-conspirator there. Alfred is unbelievably brilliant in this, because in one issue he knows that Superboy has just come to visit him, because he brings out two trays of steaming hot food when he just disappears to go feed one boy. He's like, when I come back, I know there will be two of them. So how brilliant is he? And then at the same time, they're hiding away from Alfred because Superboy has snuck into the cave. They started arguing, and at one point they hide behind the dinosaur. And so Alfred has the phenomenal line of, I can't believe my career has come to this, but can you please come out from behind the dinosaur's rear end? That's hilarious. It's just hilarious. So that the two of them grumblingly sit down to dinner. Alfred takes such good care of them. He's feeding them nice, delicious food. They're arguing over forkfuls of food. And then, of course, they sort of start fighting again, and just as they're tussling and arguing, Superman and Batman both show up and give them, you know, a teaching moment, like, you guys are a lot alike, and Superman and Batman admit to having fought multiple times before they became friends that they are now, and they understood that it took them a while to understand each other, and that the boys are going to have to take that same journey.
They had to learn that their mothers had the same name.
I know,
it was a whole
right?
process.
It's a whole thing.
That was really the clincher.
That's really when they both showed up to the whole Martha support group, and they're like, "You're here. Your mom's name is Martha. We're best friends now." Yeah, that was really the clinching.
That's how
moment.
It works.
No, but it was adorable, because they sort of boot the boys in the bum, but they also take such good care of each kid, and the two of them are allowed to go on adventures, because the fathers both realize, you're like, we can't cage you forever, and you're going to have a couple mistakes before you get the superhero thing down, and you also can't be expected to not do anything while we go off and fight all the battles and use our powers. No, we have to let you use your powers too. So now they've been sanctioned to go off on adventures and allowed and given permission to test the waters. And so now the two of them are just, after having it fought again for a whole issue, they're best friends now. I just love their ebbing relationship. It's just so cute and fun. And that's why it's my comic of the week.
Very good.
How about you? What's your comic of the week?
My comic of the week was Aquaman number 25.
I would have picked it if I hadn't loved Superman.
There were a lot of good ones. A lot of the
so
big
good.
25, 25th issues this week were great.
Yeah.
Superman, Green Arrow, Green Lanterns, Batman, they were all really good.
DC keeps dropping hits, I'm telling you.
I think this is my favorite, though. I mean, a lot of it is the art. It seems kind of shallow, but it was, I mean, the art, Stepan Sedgwick's art, and this starting with this issue is just really, really nice. It's not
beautiful.
It's not fully painted. I think he does the line art normally, and then he goes in and does like digital coloring, mm-hmm. digital painting over it, but it's just really beautiful looking, and the design work too. Some of the splash pages and two-page spreads where you see areas of Atlantis with the sea life and the ships.
Yeah.
Like everything from the costuming to the ship design to the weapons. Everything just looks really well thought out and designed. You know,
yeah.
Like it seems like the Lord of the Rings movies, the original Star Wars, where everything looks like it belongs in that world,
yeah.
You know, and there's probably a logical reason why this guy wears this kind of clothing and
yep.
and the cultural influences that led to this weapon looking like the way it
yeah,
does.
Yeah, they established a new part of town that's really kind of the dregs of society, what we think of as from the wrong side of the track. Well, this is the track, you know, and literally, because it's a giant rift in the ocean that delineates north from south, and the people that live in this crevice are the lowest of the low, not just physically, because their depth is lower than Atlantis itself, but also like in the caste system that they seem to have there. They're regarded as the dregs of society. They even have, the writer even established a name for them, didn't it? Hadlin? Is that the,
something like that? I can't remember, yeah.
Yeah, some derogatory term for where they come from.
But it sets up a really, really cool arc because you have Khorramrath as the new king and you meet some of his advisors and he's got like this bloodthirsty, seemingly fairly bloodthirsty female general in charge of the military. We see that Merc is still there, but he's kind of conflicted over the whole series of events. We're reintroduced to Volko sort of plotting with some dissidents, I suppose, in this area to try to, because they all think that Arthur is dead, so they're not necessarily plotting to restore him to the throne, but they're just trying to return Atlantis to the way it should be. Mira is up on the surface. I had forgotten that Tula was up there with her when Atlantis was sealed, so she's up there too, wearing her yellow shirt that she always wears, because that was part of like her Aqua Girl outfit back in the day. It was just like a yellow turtleneck or something. And then you've got Arthur down below operating under the name Orin, which is cool because that was his.
I was about to ask.
In the period of time when DC decided they didn't want him to have a human father and Atlantean mother, he was the child of the queen and an Atlantean sorcerer, and his birth name was Orin. Arthur was just like his Clark Kent name, but Orin was like his Kal-El name.
I see.
So this little wink and a nod to that. Like, this is another name that he sometimes uses.
I knew this meant something to you. And not only that, because the artist revealed in one panel, he had the reveal of what Aquaman has become, but he also only had one speech bubble, which was the name Orin. And so I knew that also had some weight. So I was going to ask you on mic about that. And
it's cool that it kind of sets him up as the Batman of this area, because I'm actually surprised that he puts his costume on when he saves people like this. I feel like that's kind of showing his hand. If somebody gets too good a look at him, they know that Aquaman's back.
I actually like it because it adds to the ghost myth about it. And if he really, up until, we're led to believe that for weeks he has gone on this sort of path where he works for himself and keeps away from other people and does this sort of Batman cloaking thing. And we saw a very nice demonstration of how he keeps mostly out of sight. So if he puts on his costume and you get the flash of green and you get the flash of orange, you can absolutely spread the myth of, oh my gosh, the ghost of the king has come back to protect
us. I guess. All it takes, though, is one person who doesn't believe in ghosts telling the king that Aquaman actually is back, which is what actually happens in this issue, and then the jig is up. So I kind of question the strategy behind
that that was coupled with the fact that he was fully exposed, so if he kept himself hidden behind school,
I just feel like put on like a black hood or something, and I know, but you know, like, why dress like your well internationally renowned superhero alter ego to be like your to wage your secret war on crime, but whatever. But I understand from like a myth-making perspective, it's really cool. I just question the practicality of it.
It's taking a risk.
But they also reintroduced the classic supporting character, Dolphin, who we don't learn her name in this issue. She doesn't even speak. But she's the white-haired girl
that
has the mutation. I'm trying to remember. I don't think in the old stuff she could do that. I think she was just like normal Atlantean super strong. Mm-hmm. I don't think she had like mutation powers, but it's interesting that they set up this like subclass of people that not only live in the crappy part of the kingdom, but also have
mutation,
weird mutations.
Yeah.
So there, and obviously you got the whole political allegory going on that the government is trying to, you know, dispose of undesirable elements and close themselves off from the outside world and all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the art really revitalized. I mean, they've had really good artists working on the series, but they've had a real revolving door of artists where in a 4 or 5 issue arc, you'll have two or three different artists working on it.
Yep.
I think what having this guy with his really distinctive style and moving to monthly so that he can do every issue, at least, you know, he can do a complete arc and then maybe have a few fill-ins and then do a complete arc, lends it a bit more consistency, which I feel is particularly important for this new status quo where you're really... You can tell this is the first part of what's going to be like this epic story where he reclaims his throne and does all this other stuff. And I feel like you want to have that nice artistic through line there.
There was a little bit of drama being generated because now there's this new girl in the mix. And I knew that she was important, but I didn't know again until you brought her up. What's her name? Dolphin, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Was she classically, she didn't have a mutation. She was classically also mute? In her former
she wasn't mute. I'm not convinced she's mute here either. Maybe she just is shy or something. I don't know. Maybe she'll be mute, but she wasn't She wasn't.
I mean, he asked her legitimately, like, if she can talk, and she sort of looked down and pointed at her throat.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe that's part of the mutation. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were necessarily setting up a love triangle either, even though the last page, the way it was drawn, kind of set that up with Mira diving down because she learns that he's alive. So she's diving down to try to.
But that was another thing, is that they really led into it. Like, they leaned into it pretty hard because she said, nothing's going to get between me and Arthur now. And we're thinking, oh, the wall. And she's thinking of the wall.
But
now there's this other girl.
I think they're going to do that, though. I mean, maybe they're kind of teasing it, but I don't think they're going to go that way. For one thing, classically, she was, and she actually ended up marrying and having a child with Tempest.
Oh.
So that would almost seem weirdly
incestuous
in a way. Like, not that, I mean, Aquaman probably isn't as old as he was in the old comics, but she's probably a good 10 years younger than he is. So I'm not, I mean, not that that's a deal breaker, but so much of this arc has been about setting up him and Mira and him proposing and everything like that. I don't think after being separated for a couple of months and he meets this girl who's half his age and all of a sudden he's going to fall for her and forget about Mira.
Yeah,
I don't think they're going to do
that. I don't buy that.
If this was a new writer, then I might say, oh, maybe he's going to go in a different direction. But this is the same writer who's been setting up the Arthur Mira stuff for a year now.
I just don't want them to play with that.
I don't think they're going to.
He's got so much on his plate. Like, can't they have a nice, stable relationship where they're just... You know,
I mean, they might tease it. They might have him feel like some attraction to her, and maybe she becomes infatuated with him or something. But I honestly don't think they're going to do a whole like he dumps Mira to be with this girl kind of thing. I think it's going to be like they get closer because they're fighting down there, and she, you know, and he doesn't know if she's okay and if he'll ever see her again. So maybe he's like, maybe I should make the most of it or whatever. But they might tease it for a little bit of drama, but I don't think they're going to actually go there.
Yeah, good.
But yeah, okay. It was a really good issue.
Yeah, it was. It was tremendous.
So should we move on to your pop quiz?
I am ready for my pop quiz.
So this week I'm going to be quizzing you about classic Wrath of Khan quotes.
Oh, awesome. So for anybody not in the know, we've been watching the whole original series of Star Trek. I had never seen it before, and actually Trevor hasn't either, although he had watched the movies before. And so now we finished that and we're watching the movies. At some point we're going to do a megasode about Star Trek.
Yes, we will.
Yeah. So that'll be, look out for that. But anyway, yeah. So we just finished watching Wrath of Khan. So...
Correct.
Go ahead.
So I am going to read the first few words of a quote, and then you're going to have to finish the quote.
Ooh, no multiple choice on this one. It's feet to the fire. All right, I'm ready.
You all set?
Yeah.
The needs of the many
outweigh the needs of the few, or the one.
Very good.
Yay.
All right. Uh-huh. Number two.
Yes.
I have been.
And always shall be your friend.
Oh, very good. I think you're probably going to do very well on this. All right, number three.
Uh-huh.
From hell's heart.
I stab at thee.
Very good. Number four.
Uh-huh.
Of all the souls I have encountered in my travels.
Oh, his was the most human.
Ah, very good. All right. And number five.
Uh-huh. Khan.
Very good.
Yay.
5 out of 5.
Awesome. Hey, thank you for that quiz. I'm super excited. Finally, I get a perfect score.
I could have been I could have been like.
You could have been vicious with this.
Captain's log, start 8.
24.
That would have been pretty evil.
0.7. That would have been really gross, yeah. Oh, I would have failed that one.
Very good.
Yay!
So we only have one show to talk about this week, and that's Doctor Who. So the episode is called The Eaters of Light.
Yes.
So what you might not have realized about this episode, unless you heard people talking about it on podcasts you might have overheard me listening to, is that this episode is the first time that they brought back a writer from the classic series. The writer of this episode, Rona Monroe, actually wrote the very last episode that aired of the original run of Doctor Who in whatever year that would have been, 86, 87.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought her back to write this episode. It's the first time that someone who's written for the original series or the classic series wrote for this one.
My goodness. She'd
written the very last one. And that was, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah. That's a big gap, yeah.
So I thought this was a really good episode. I enjoyed it more than last week's. I thought it was, I mean, it's kind of similar in some ways where you have the Doctor and Bill dropped into a situation where they kind of have to make peace between two opposing factions.
Yep.
But I don't know, for whatever reason, whether just the characters are more interesting or what.
Yep.
It seemed like there was more going on thematically too, the whole question of expanding an empire and the cost that has on the people, the idea that once everybody can speak the same language, then it becomes a lot easier to, you know.
I mean, that's objectively true, but I like that they bring it up.
And then the whole thing at the end with the Doctor seemed like he was going to sacrifice himself and live out the rest of his regenerations holding off this thing. And all the stuff with the crows learning to speak the name of the girl that, you know,
they're not
sacrificed herself.
Yeah, they're not clawing, they're remembering.
Yeah,
that's
so I I don't know. Like, it again, a fairly standard plot. There's two opposing forces, and there's a monster, and they need to learn to work together to stop the monster.
Right,
but
the enemy
I just thought there was more going on in the story thematically, and the characters were more interesting. You got to know a couple of the Romans a bit better. Mm-hmm. I did think it was a bit of an odd choice to have Bill meet a Roman soldier early on, then instantly kill him off, and then have her meet another Roman soldier that then we get to know. It's like, why not just have, you know what I mean? That seemed like a bit of a weird start and stop in the storyline. Why not have her meet the Roman soldiers that she ended up meeting earlier so that then we could have spent more time getting to know them? Instead, we spend 5 minutes getting to know this guy who's instantly killed, and then she finds more Roman soldiers that are more interesting.
That's another cost of war type of moment, isn't it? Because A, he saves her, and so then she is able to relate that to his comrades, who then, that's kind of her buy-in, but at the same time, it's also
have her meet all of them all together.
And
then the one she strikes up a friendship with can die.
But
don't have to have the whole meeting, losing someone, running away, meeting more people, then getting to know them again. It just felt like a bit of a weird start and stop. I did like
the way
that they really established, which is true from a historical perspective, that a lot of the hang-ups we have about sexual orientation now are, we think of it as being, this is the way it's always been, this way. And we're actually being really progressive when we decide to grant equal rights to gay marriage and so on. This is the first time in history anybody's been as progressive as we are.
Like,
back then it was. And I was listening to one of my podcasts, and people that actually have studied this period in history will say that that's true so far as it goes, but they did have their own, no society is perfect. They did have their own hang-ups. Like, it was completely fine to have relationships with men and women, regardless of your gender, so long as the same-sex partner was not of the same social class as you. If they were, then it was a little weird, and you were still expected to marry. When you married, you were still expected to marry someone from the opposite gender.
Mm-hmm.
So it was seen as being okay as far as like a youthful indiscretion,
sure,
so to speak.
Yeah.
But when it came time to actually be serious, there were serious like social implications if you didn't operate inside the. So in a way, we're still doing better than them. But I take the point as intended, which is that, you know, we think ourselves as being uniquely open-minded.
Right.
Compared to the long arc of history, but
understanding
that hasn't always—that's not necessarily the case. A lot of our hang-ups these days stem from religious and cultural institutions, which are actually quite young in terms of the overall length of time humans have been on the earth, and so we're actually kind of two steps forward, one step back in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about one of the other things I saw people thought was funny was the way Nardole basically instantly goes native. Like, the doctor's gone for a couple of days and he come back and Nardole's become like the face painted storyteller of the group, and they've like instantly adopted him. It's like, well, I guess I might as well make the most of it.
That was a hilarious. I'm trying to ingratiate myself. Yeah.
I did like the scene at the end with Missy again, where they come in and she's on the TARDIS. The doctor's got it so that she can't leave the TARDIS, so it's still safe, as if the master could never devise some way of breaking out of that trap.
I mean, she established it pretty well. Like, you think I've been around for as long as you have. You think I can't find my way out of
a
door.
And I did think the scene, I mean, they were great. The two actors obviously are great when they're playing against each other in the scene at the end where she listens to the music and she cries. But I just felt like, and we're going into the two-part season finale now where that whole story will
pay off,
come to a head.
Yeah.
I'm ready for that because I feel like it's been spinning its wheels a little bit for a week or two, where this is the second or third episode in a row where we have an episode that's completely unrelated to Missy.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have a little two-minute scene at the end where we say, let's catch up with Missy and watch her cry. Like, we've seen that several episodes in a row now, and I'm ready
for... Just a couple. I mean, I think they've been flavoring it appropriately, because the first one is the fact that she remembers the people that she killed. The second one is that she gets caught off by...
It's the same beat, though. The doctor catches up with her at the end of the episode, and she cries in a way that she's never cried before. It's literally same beat.
It's the same beat in terms of, like, a pink is not the same as a fuchsia, and to girls, we understand the difference, and to guys, it seems like, it's just pink. What are you talking about? I mean, it's different shades of a related emotion. I'll grant you that. But I don't know. It didn't feel like playing the same note. But you're right. If it goes on any longer without some sort of a resolution. But I think knowing that it's about to have some a plot advancement in one direction or another is definitely, it's the time. It's time.
I also felt a little disoriented in terms of the characters' arcs at the beginning of this episode, because Nardole was saying, what about the vault? You've got to guard the vault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not allowed. And I'm like, But you just, first of all, we've had two or three episodes where he was tagging along with them on a fun adventure and the vault didn't even come up. So like, wait, now you're worried about the, and to me, the season's been kind of back and forth about, in this episode, we're going to be worried about the vault. In this episode, we're not. But the other thing is, he's like, what about the vault? You got to go to the vault. And at the end, Missy's there and Nardole can't believe that the doctor let Missy out of the vault. And I'm like, Nardole, literally, in the last episode, you let Missy out of the vault and into the TARDIS to help you. But nobody remembers that in this episode. They mention it really briefly. They're like, but, you know, you trusted me last week to help you fix the TARDIS.
There you go.
But no, the character, because these are, the thing with Doctor Who is that it's generally a different writer on pretty much every episode, and there's no writer's room, necessarily. I mean, Stephen Moffat is overseeing the writing, yeah. But he assigns a script to someone, they write it, and it comes back. And it's not the first time in the show where I've seen, like, I kind of feel like these two writers were working from the same notes, but nobody, that they didn't really communicate with each other. And I felt like Moffat should have kind of gone in and drew some of those lines a bit more between the episodes. Cause I really felt like the way the last episode ended with the doctor and Missy seeing each other in the TARDIS,
mm-hmm.
and she's been let out of the vault and now she's in the TARDIS and the doctor can't believe what's happening.
Right.
And then this episode starts and everything's back to normal. I guess I just put her back in the vault and didn't talk about it. Like, but then they let her out of the vault again. Like, it just seems like
yeah, they are yo-yoing with the vault.
I wanted something in the beginning of this episode that followed through from where the characters were emotionally at the end of the last episode, where Nardole was maybe apologizing for having let her out of the vault, and the doctor saying, don't worry about it, it was necessary.
Right.
Or even some reference to the fact that they just had to pop back to the university to put Missy back in the vault or something, but instead they're just off on a new adventure and like, wait, is Missy still in there? Where's Missy? And then it's not till the end that you realize that, oh, they put her in the vault, but then the doctor let her out again. And it just feels like, wait, like I wasn't quite sure, you know?
Yes.
I was trying to figure out where everybody was in terms of that storyline, and the episode wasn't telling me. So I don't know if that was just like whose fault that is. I feel like, I mean, it kind of has to be, the writers don't know everything all the other writers are doing. I feel like that was Moffat's job to go in and kind of connect those dots a bit more cleanly between those episodes, and for whatever reason it just didn't happen. But that's a minor point.
It is, yeah. I mean, I didn't feel it as deeply as you did. For me, I noticed that it was a little dissonant, but I didn't really, I had enough, you know, like I had enough connection between one another. I mean, Missy's quote, quip back to him about like, it was fine for you last week when I helped with the TARDIS, but so I didn't really bump on it too hard. But yeah, you're right. It would be more elegant if they had a little more continuity between. But I feel like they do have some, you know, so it's not completely void of connections. So I don't know. Maybe it's just a matter of airtime where they don't have enough to squeeze everything in.
They have. What happens sometimes too, because there's no writer's room, because these are all freelancers that are getting assigned scripts, sometimes the scripts will come in a different order than they want.
Yeah.
And so they'll have to shuffle the order of the episodes and rewrite them slightly to make that work. But
sure.
They can't fully make it work. I remember one of the classic example from earlier in Moffat's era was Curse of the Black Spot, the Amy Rory 11th Doctor episode on the pirate ship.
Okay.
Where the episode prior to that, Amy and Rory, their daughter had been, their baby had been taken from them.
Oh.
And then this very next episode, nobody mentions it. And you're like,
true.
They wouldn't still be thinking about the fact that their child was, but because that episode was supposed to happen earlier in the season and it got pushed back, that's why. So I kind of feel like maybe that happens sometimes when you're working with a bunch of freelancers.
Of
like
course.
Maybe this episode was supposed to be earlier and they had to shuffle around a couple of the Missy scenes.
Right, based on
what was
ready
first. Because you could slot them
first,
basically into any episode.
Because they think, I mean, you see the show once a week and so you think, oh wow, they write, produce, film and edit everything in 1 week. Or at least, you know, to our little magical heads, that's how it seems, but absolutely not. And to get a really nice Doctor Who script, it could take several weeks of solid and quick writing and revision before you have something that's ready for the actors to get their teeth into. And then even then, while it's filming, it goes through a revision or two, like at least slightly. So yeah, keeping that in mind is definitely a good grain to keep in mind, because that's why they have multiple script writers, so that they can get more than one script and really have a full season instead of relying on one solid person to do so much writing and revision. It's almost impossible for somebody to churn that out in the several months, along with all the demands of filming and so forth. So yeah, it's good to keep in mind.
That's it for our shows.
Yeah, super. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, we're going to have a very thin summer in terms of shows, but we have some stuff planned for you, Smarties, so worry not. So if you want to reach out to us, we have an email address, mailbag@smartspodcast.com. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. Our Twitter handle is @smartspodcast, and on Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. How about a funny sound?
Hello, computer.